short thing that may have heard before, just to reiterate it again. First, you may know that the source of Badeken, right, that the source of the custom, that the kala is veiled before the marriage, is actually derived from Parshas Vayetzara, where Rivka sees Eliezer at a distance, and she falls off the camel. Oh, no, I'm sorry, she's looking at a distance, and she falls off the camel. The pasuk says, "But tikachas so'if batishchas." She took the kerchief and she covered her face. And this is the source this very day of the Badeken. But the Mefarshim are really in disagreement as to what is the significance of why does she cover herself. So they have two different interpretations. The Nitziv understands this, which really would not make it a universal minhag, that Rivka was in tremendous awe of Yitzchak. I think it's, I'm not sure if I talked about here or somewhere else, that the relationship of the Nitziv says between Yitzchak and Rivka was very different. The relations of Abraham. And that's why, as we said, when Abraham has problems with Yishmael, Sarah can confront him on it. And with Rivka, and we'll talk about the nature of that problem, Rivka has to engage in a subterfuge or a deception. And then Isif points out that the two reasons for this are, number one, Rivka married at a very young age, according to Chazal. Rivka was 3 and Yitzchak was 40. And the second reason is Yitzchak was a korban. Yitzchak was sanctified as a korban. Yitzchak was otherworldly. Yitzchak was not in this world, and therefore it was difficult for Rivka to relate to him on a certain level. So according to some Mefarshim, the idea of covering up was an expression of her awe and her reverence from him. Suffice it to say that that's not the reason that's given for Badeken today. We don't say that there has to be an awe and reverence for the chassan, so to speak. The other explanation that's given, there are three explanations. One explanation is this is the awe and the reverence, which really pertains to the Yitzchak and Rivka in particular. The other reason that's given is the notion that the Kala is now declaring that from now on she's not available to the general public. From now on she is miyukhedet. She's uniquely connected to one person. And the third reason that's given is very interesting. It's almost the opposite idea. It's the Kala is declaring to her husband that she retains for herself a zone of privacy, which the husband is not supposed to invade. She's setting aside a certain autonomy within marriage that the woman is designed to bring. You see, this is exactly the opposite of the Nitziv's point. If we say Rivka's covering herself up to declare that, then rather than being an expression of awe, it's kind of telling Yitzchak, I'm still my own person on some level. But again, you know, the problem is there very often is a shyling in trying to trace this as the halakhic source of the custom, because the yet another explanation that's given for Badeken is it is the way the husband is supposed to cover her. And it's the way of the husband finishing off the marriage, meaning to say the first stage of the marriage is erusin, it's the giving of the ring, and the second stage is the chuppah, when you bring the person, the husband brings the wife into a separate room or the like. So some commentaries say that the badeket is the chuppah, the sense of the chassan, not consummating, but finishing the marriage ceremony. And that's, according to that logic, by the way, the badeket should not be after the chuppah, it should be before, that should be between the giving of the ring and the yichud. And therefore, some would actually move the badeket there. Halakhically, if the badeket is a form of the suin, which is the completion of the marriage ceremony. So there are different ways of looking at it, and some view it as a declaration of independence and autonomy, some view it as a notion of submission, and as the notion of husband finishing off the ceremony. Of course, in Rivka's case, the one thing that the Torah says explicitly is Yitzchak didn't cover her, she covered herself. Mm-hmm. So that certainly doesn't correspond with the idea of the Badeken of the husband covering her. In addition, the nusach that is said out of Badeken, there is a nusach that is supposed to be said, is taken exactly from the bracha that Laban gave his sister Rivka. Ahoseinu, our sister, at hayi li alfei revavah, may you be the mother of thousands of myriads. Ve'yivash zareich eit shar oyeva sona, and may your children be victorious against any and those who are their enemies. Well, it should be said. No, I know. But it should be said. Not by everybody necessarily, but parents, will often come up and give a bracha. The chasan should give a bracha to the kala. And the pasuk that is often said is this pasuk of Achoseinu, Ad Hayili Alfei Rebbe. It is very interesting that we learn out a lot of laws. You might think, well, why on earth should I pay any attention to what Lavan does? In other words, do we look at what Lavan does and we say, oh, that's a raya, that's a proof that we should follow this? And yet you find that a lot of halachos that pertain to marriage are in fact derived from Lavan, both in terms of Lavan and Rivka, and later Lavan marrying off his daughters Rachel and Leah. Let me just give you a short list just in terms of the halachos that we derive from Rishon, from what the evil doers did. One is, they say, well, the minhag of Badekin, of course, is what Rivka did. The bracha of Badekin, Achoseinu Ati Yilal Pei Rebbe, that is derived from what Lavan, Sewell is already dead, what Lavan and his cohorts said. The, I don't want to say this is an halacha because I don't want to worry anybody, but you know, the minhag that you try to marry off your daughters in the order of birth. Again, it's not a strict halacha, and you don't have to be overly concerned with it. But it is a lechatchila, that if all things are equal, you try to marry off the older before the younger. That is derived from whom? From what Lavan tells Yaakov. When Yaakov switches, when Lavan switches Rachel and Leah, where he says, Leah Yatza came to Komeno, we don't do it in our place to give the younger before the older. By the way, I think I pointed out that that's an exquisite idea of sarcasm and turning the knife, because what he's telling Yaakov is, and Lavan is playing the tzaddik here. Lavan is saying, I don't know where you grow up, where the younger takes away from the older like you did with Esav, but we are much more refined and cultured people. In other words, Lavan, who just cheated Yaakov after Yaakov working for 7 years, paints himself as the more righteous and the more decent person by saying, Bimkomeinu, in our place, we don't behave the way you behave. But nevertheless, from Lavan's statement, it is derived. The Chachila one should, the older should be married first. Again, I say it's a Chachila, if all things are equal, so to speak, if you have two daughters and they're both about to get engaged, so, you know, you arrange for the older wedding to be first, but there really is no reason to delay. Another halacha that's learned out is that, now this doesn't apply today, but I just want to give you the information, is if you remember, Lavan originally said, Teshev Hanara Itano, let Rivka stay, Yamim O Asor. So Yamim, Rashi says, means a year, 12 months, or at least 10 months. But the Chachila, he pointed out, let her stay here for 12 months. Yamim, Rashi says, means a year. What is the significance of 12 months? So here, let me just give you a little information. The Jewish marriage ceremony actually comprises two distinct portions. We do them together today, but they used to be separated by a whole year. Ceremony number one is called Kiddushin or Erusin. This is often translated as betrothal. That is done with the chasan giving the kala a ring, or anything of money really. You can actually give a penny, it's just as good. Did you ever see, technically, in order for a kiddushin to be valid, the thing that the chasan gives the kala has to be. So, when you have the witnesses under the chuppah, the tzaddik kiddushin asks the witnesses, do you think this ring is worth a penny? And the witnesses have to certify that in their judgment it's worth a penny. The expensive gold ring. But be it as it may, that is erusin. Right? That is only stage one. Now, in the time of the Torah and the time of Chazal, even in the time of the Gemara, at that stage, the woman was an aishus ish. She was a married woman, but she continued to live at home with her parents. And the marriage was not consummated for a whole other year. There was 1 year. Now, we would call this in secular terms engagement, but it's not engagement at all. It's much more severe than engagement. For example, once a woman is an arusa, she would need a get. You couldn't just break an engagement. Etc. If she would commit adultery, it would be a chiyuv misa, capital crime. So it really was a marriage, but it was a marriage that had not yet been consummated, in which husband and wife were not living together. What the purpose of that break is not entirely clear, and it wasn't mandatory. You could shorten it, but the custom was, from the time of the Torah till the time of Chazal, to have 12 months between Erusin, and the second stage was Nisuin. And the Suen is effected by the recitation of 7 brachos under the chuppah. And then, something like yichud, when the husband symbolically brings the wife into his home, and that is what we call symbolic consummation. He didn't, in other words, for nisuin, it did not require actual relationship, but it required the symbolic consummation of bringing into the house. Now, once there is nisuin, then the husband and wife are completely married. That would mean, for example, the husband's obligation of supporting his wife. It only takes effect upon nisuin, not upon erusin. If she marries a kohen, for example, she's not allowed to eat truma until nisuin, not during erusin. In other words, there's kind of an interim level. If a woman makes a vow, so if she's an arusa, only the husband and the father together would have the power to annul the vow. Only after nisuin would the husband have that authority. So these are differences between erusin and nisuin. Now, as I say, they used to be separated by 1 year. That would mean that essentially whoever was paying for the wedding would have to make two weddings, right? You'd make a suda of erusin and a suda of nisuin. And this existed all the way, in Klal Yisrael, all the way until around the 1000s, which is the time of Rashi. And in fact, Rashi is credited. It's a kind of innovation. Rashi is credited with collapsing the two stages into a single ceremony. And that is what we do now. The ring, the giving of the ring is erusin. Right after we give the ring, we read the ksuba. Now, there's no reason to read the ksuba. Why do you have to read the ksuba? You already signed the ksuba. You read the ksuba because that is a hepsik. That is designed to break, to divide erusin, which is part one, from nisuin, which is part two. Nisuin, which is part two, consists of the recitation of Sheva Brachos. See, most people don't picture it this way. Most people picture, like, the recitation of Sheva Brachos is the end of something. Mm-hmm. It's not the end of something. It is the beginning of Act 2. And Act 2 ends in the Yichud room. Okay? So the way it works is, giving of the ring is erusin, which is Act 1. The reading of the Ksuva is really an intermission. There's no halakha, you don't have to read the Ksuva. The Ksuva has to be signed, of course, in terms of obligations in the case of divorce. But Rashi was misaking. Rashi enacted as a custom that we read the ksuba between the erusin and the nisuin in order to have a break. And Act 2, which would have occurred 1 year later, meaning when there was erusin, there was no Sheva Brachos. Act 2 is recitation of Sheva Brachos and Yichud, which is symbolic consummation. Now, since I mentioned that the definition of a symbolic consummation meant that the chassan brings the kala into his home, that is why it is halakhically proper that the yichud room either be owned by the chassan, or if you don't own that tefillah, it is proper to rent it. Again, the concept is many, many people are machmir, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, where they're a bit more meticulous, is they'll actually pay a dollar. That it should belong, that room should belong specifically to the chassan, so it becomes the vice. Right, that is, now, just for a second. Now, why did Rashi combine them? Why didn't you separate them by a year? So there were really two concerns. One concern was the problem of immorality, which already the Gemara alludes to, and that is, you're having a situation where husband and wife are tied to each other, they're married, they're not allowed to be with anybody else, and for 1 year they can't even be with each other. That was considered to be conducive to immorality and the like, just like today, people talk about not having long engagements, etc. So therefore Rashi felt it was better to bring them together. And the second reason was economic. That it was too expensive to make two weddings, and Jews were very oppressed in those days. Remember, these were the days of the Crusades, and therefore Rashi said better to get married as quickly as possible. By the way, just to show you, there are other takanas that were made that way as well. The Gemara says that although min haTorah, the father has the power to marry off his daughter who's a ketana. In fact, we've seen some people try that even today, a daughter who's below bas mitzvah. The Gemara says it is not proper to do that, because what if the girl grows up and doesn't like the guy she's married to? So you've created an aveira, you've created a destructive relationship, right? So the Gemara itself says it is prohibited, even though it's possible, it is prohibited to marry off your daughter when she's a ketana until she is old enough to know what she really wants. However, Rabbeinu Tam was Rashi's grandson. Rabbeinu Tam writes, from the vantage point of the 1100s in France, that Bizman Hazeh, our situation is so precarious, and, you know, a person can lose all of their fortune, you know, overnight, if we have the financial resources to be able to support a new family, it is better to marry off our daughters as dependents in order to provide them with security rather than create a situation where perhaps we won't be able to do it later. So the Beit HaTam actually said that where Jewish communities are very precarious and economically unstable, he was in favor of child marriages. Now again, Ms. Manazah, at least in America, we don't have that situation. Therefore, we're back to the Gemara's ruling that it's forbidden. I'm sorry, was there a question?
I thought that the chuppah was symbolic of the chassan bringing the car into his home.
Okay, the problem is this. The problem is you got to have nesuin. Okay, nesuin is the operative term. There are many, many interpretations as to what is nesuin, so we try to incorporate all of them. Some people say nesuin has to be yichud. Yichud means seclusion. That's why we have yichud. Some people say the chuppah can be symbolic of the chassan home. Right? So we have the chuppah. In fact, according to that, by the way, logically, the best way to do it, which nobody does, is to set up the chuppah after the ring ceremony. Instead of giving the ring under the chuppah, you give the ring not under the chuppah. Then you call it the chuppah. That would be the proper way of doing it. I'll do that. And Sfardim cover... Well, even among Ashkenazim, many say it is proper for the chassan to walk down and escort the kala to the chuppah, that's bringing her into the home. Another interpretation is spreading a talis over the kala. And Svartan, if you know, the chassan and kala are under a single talis. That's another interpretation. Some German has that custom as well. But again, what you're doing here is, there are many interpretations in the Rishonim, the commentators, as to what is this nesuin. So our wedding, Minhagim, try to incorporate all of them. So there are different reasons, but the reason I'm bringing this in is the following. How did Chazal know that the original gap between Erisin and Nesuin would be 12 months? Where do you get the 12 months? The answer is you get that from Lavan, because Lavan suggested let her stay for a year. Because remember, when Eliezer gave her the jewelry, that was Erisin, that's the Kedushin, right? Eliezer is a Shaliach. Eliezer is, you can marry through proxy, we don't do it today for a number of reasons. But I can make a shaliach, I can make somebody a messenger to marry a woman for me. Eliezer was a shaliach. The giving of the rings and jewelry was Erisin. Laban's suggestion of 12 months is because between Erisin and Nesuin, you can have up to 12 months. So the point is this. Oh yes, and yet another source from Laban. Again, I'm trying to show you briefly halachos of marriage that we learn out of Lavan's context. So we mentioned so far the bracha, or at least the custom of giving a certain blessing at the bedekin, which is what Lavan did. We learn out the 12 months between Erisin and Nisuin. Another halacha that we learn out is, and this is actually a halacha, we learn out the idea that l'chatchila, the older gets married before the younger. That's the third one. A fourth one, and the fourth one is very much a halacha l'maisa, is a halacha that is called Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. That means you don't mix together one joy into another joy. What practically does that mean? It means, for example, why can't you make a wedding during Chol HaMoed? What's wrong with make the wedding Chol HaMoed? Because since even on Chol HaMoed there's a mitzvah to rejoice in the Yomtiv, one does not want to detract from the joy of the Yomtiv by making another type of simcha. Ein ma'arvin simcha v'simcha, which is why we don't get married on Chol HaMoed or the like. Well, one of the sources of Ein ma'arvin simcha v'simcha is what Laban told Yaakov after Laban switched around Leah for Rachel. And it says, Malei Shavuot. Now, very often people misinterpret this. Malei Shavuot Oz does not mean that he tells Yaakov you got to work another 7 years till you get Rachel, but it means finish the week of celebration. See, Rachel was given on credit. Leah was a cash purchase, so to speak. For Leah, Yaakov had to work 7 years, but Rachel was right after the week. Now, first of all, you see that's seven brachas. Malei Shavuot Oz. Where do you get a week? The week is the week of celebration. So you see from Laban that you celebrate for a week. And why can't he marry Rachel within the week? Because when one is preoccupied with the joy of wedding number one, one does not make wedding number two. Eima arvin simcha is simcha. So look at how many laws we learn out of Lavan. We learn out the order of marriage. We learn out Sheva Brachos. We learn out, not Sheva, I shouldn't say Sheva Brachos. We don't learn out Brachos. We learn out Sheva Shemei HaMishnah, 7 days of rejoicing. We learn Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha. We learn the custom of a Bedekin Bracha. We learn the 12 months between Erisin and the Suin. So one question you could raise is the following. Why on earth is what Lavan does any type of proof as to what we should do at all? Lavan was not a tzaddik. Lavan was a Russia. Do we look at what Rishoyim do? I mean, do we look at Paro, for example, and say, well, Paro said so-and-so, therefore we should say so-and-so? So here, the Mefarshim explain that the nature of the precedent here is not because since Lavan does it, therefore I do it. That doesn't make sense. What Lavan does has no bearing on me. But rather, if the Torah records, anything that is recorded in the Torah is designed to teach you a lesson. And the Emes says, even Rishayim sometimes do things right. And if the Torah records something that a Rasha does, and it is not labeled as an evil thing, then in effect the Torah is telling you, learn even from the Rishayim. That we in fact, in other words, it's not Lavan that's teaching me this, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's teaching me this. Lavan may have done it for totally of the wrong reasons. What Lavan does is not relevant at all. But if the Torah records what Lavan does, it's because the Torah wants to teach me something. By the way, just one, let me just go back for a second. The notion of Ersin and Nesuin, that under a chuppah two different ceremonies are taking place, this is why, if you recall from your first wedding, this is why there are two cups of wine. In other words, when the Masada Kedushin begins the wedding ceremony, he recites Borei Pri Hagafet. And then the Chasan and Kala drink. But then you'll notice, after the ring is given, and after the Ksuba is read, so before the Sheva Brachos are recited, a second cup of wine is either poured or was poured, and Rei Pri Hagafet is recited again. And a second cup of wine. Why are there two cups of wine? And the answer is, because these were originally, this is a vestige of the fact, that these were ceremonies that were separated by 12 months. Right, the Sheva Brachos took place 12 months later. Now, even though Rashi combined them, but to show us that these were two different ceremonies, that's why we have two different cups of wine. It's a remnant of that idea. Of course, a lot of the other stuff, who walked down the procession, right? That halakha is not that is not structurally. I mean, those are extra things that people add. But the basic idea of the erisin and the nesuin. So that was just one thing I wanted to point out, the interesting idea that we learn out halachos from Lava. Let me ask you a question though. Let me just bring up this thing. You know, we see the principle of Ein Ma'arvin Simcha V'Simcha. Sometimes people raise a question, where are you allowed to have, Reverend Moon, for example, marries off a thousand couples. And the truth is, sometimes even, I think it was there to show, some other places, sometimes they make mass chasanas. For, let's say, Russian Jews who are marrying, they sometimes marry off many of them at the same time. And the question becomes, is that a violation of this principle of not intermingling simcha b'simcha? Perhaps in spirit it's a violation, but halakhically it's not. And the reason is, because it all depends who's the Baal Simcha. Meaning to say, the violation was that Yaakov, who was obligated to be Mesameach with his wife, would not be allowed to have some other simcha that takes away from that. But if Reuven and Sarah are getting married, and Shimon and Leah are getting married, even if they're getting married at the same time, Reuven is not the Baal Simcha in Shimon's wedding, and Shimon is not the Baal Simcha in Reuven's wedding, so each one has their own simcha. So halakhically, don't confuse us, halakhically, for two different couples to get married at the same time under a single chasna even, is not treated as Ein Ma'arvin Simcha B'Simcha, because each individual is their own. In other words, of course they'll feel the joy for each other, but each individual is chayav, is obligated only in that one simcha. The question you could raise is this though, and this is a machlokas haposkim. Let's assume that I have two daughters, And for whatever reason, I want to make one wedding. Whatever, people can't afford it. I want to make one wedding. I haven't heard this in America, but I can imagine that in Europe it certainly was a question where you want to marry your two daughters off at the same time. So that's a machlokas. Do I consider that a marv and simcha b'simcha, or do I say no? Technically, although parents of course rejoice, but technically, the one that's chayiv and simcha is the chasan and kala. The parents are there as guests. Paying guests. Technically, the chasna is the bride and the groom. They are the bali simcha. The parents are not. Halakhically, the parents are not. It's not like a bris. In a bris, the one that is chayav in the simcha is the father in particular, and the mother as well. Although the chiv of the bris is on the father. At a chasna, the bali simcha are the chasan and the kala, and not the parents. The parents are there, but the ones who are obligated in simcha are the bride and the groom.
Based on what you said, what if you have two baby boys and they both
came in
bris? Would you be obligated to have two separate brits for them since you were the one?
Well, yeah.
Twin
the question, well, first of all, the answer is that this does come up when you have twins, right? When you have twins, the bris should be the same day, at least if it's the eighth day of birth. And we say no because technically, I misspoke for a second, technically, a bris, one is not chayav and simcha. One is obligated to make a meal, but one is not obligated in the joy that you have with a in fact, it's interesting that you know that the custom in America, not in America, everywhere outside of Eretz Yisrael, is we do not make a Shechiyanu at a bris. Now you go to a bris, the bracha of Shechiyanu is not recited, although it's a very happy occasion. In Eretz Yisrael, the custom is Shechiyanu is recited at a bris. We don't recite a bris, the Rav Moshe says, because since the baby feels some pain, our joy is not complete at a bris, because there's an element of pain that's there. Although many say that the parents feel the pain more than the baby. In fact, medically, there's something very special about the eighth day. It's very, very interesting. I don't remember the scientific detail, but there's something about the nerve endings not being completely closed in that part of the body till around the ninth or tenth day after birth. So the eighth day is actually an optimal time to do a bris, causing the child very little pain, which is why sometimes when people have to delay a bris, sometimes it's harder. If a child gets a bris at a month, it hurts a lot more, precisely because the nerve endings are more developed. So there's a chachma you see in these mitzvahs. Of course, we don't pitch a mitzvah on the scientific considerations, but as we go along, we see all sorts of things that these mitzvahs have that one would not understand on a superficial level. So that was just something I just wanted to finish off in terms of the notion of the halachos. See, Sefer Bereishis does not have a lot of mitzvahs. Right? What mitzvahs are in Sefer Bereishis? The mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply, prur of having children, the mitzvah of bris mila, of circumcision, and of course the final one is the mitzvah of not eating the sciatic nerve, not eating the gid hanasha. Right, because that's where the angel is Yaakov. That's why Jews can't have sirloin steak. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because the gid hanasha, like human beings have so we have a gid hanasha too, but the gid hanasha is a very long nerve that is located in the hind quarter of an animal. And theoretically, if you remove that nerve, you could eat the rest of the meat, but it's very hard to do. It's very hard to do. And therefore, in America, where meat is, there's not a shortage of meat, so kosher slaughterhouses routinely sell the whole hindquarter of the animal to goyim, to treif butcher stores. Now, the hindquarter has a lot of meat cuts, sirloin and different other things, which is why you can't get a kosher cut of that, because the gid hanasha was never removed. In Eretz Yisrael, where there is a shortage of meat, so they do what is called travering. Travering is they remove the gid hanasha, so you can get certain cuts of meat that you cannot get in America. Okay. But although the Book of Bereishis does not have a lot of mitzvos, but there are these halachos that are at least derived from the Book of Bereishis, which don't count as mitzvos from the Torah, because, you see, they're not derived from commandments, they're just derived from behavior. This is an important idea. That in order for something to be a commandment, an obligation, Hashem has to say, you shall do this, or you shall not do this. But these halachas that I'm referring to are not derived from imperative statements. Hashem didn't say, you shall do this. But we look at what is recorded about the avos and the imahos
And even Lava, that's really the Chiddush of what I'm saying, even the Rasha. And if the Torah records it, it is a good conduct that we should emulate. So it's not one of the mitzvos, but it's a conduct that we imitate that the Chachamim then record as a halacha. So it becomes a rabbinic halacha, because the Chachamim may have made it mandatory, but it's derived from the conduct of personalities in the Torah.
It seems to me that Lavan has a lot of esteem based on
yeah.
it. So why did the Torah specifically pick Lavan? I mean, it does seem like we learn these things from Lavan. Mm-hmm. Why Lavan?
Well, I think there are a few ideas here. One idea is that the Torah is teaching me that you should learn to accept MS and good things from whatever source it comes. Right? Chazal had a saying, Kabel ha-emes m'misha amra. But of course, I should digress, but that actually is a... You see in Chazal, there's a lot of tension in that principle. That the Chachamim are aware that that's a valid principle, but it's a dangerous principle that can lead to a great sakana. The classic discussion of this is with Elisha ben Avliya. Remember, Elisha ben Avliya was the one great Kana of the Mishnah who became an Apikoros. He became a heretic. He became a non-believer. In fact, there's even a novel about it, As a Driven Leaf, as a fictionalized account of Elisha ben Avliya's turmoil. And Elisha ben Avliya, again, the Chazal has different stories. Why did he become an Apikoros? Some say because he once saw a child climbing up, a father told the child, climb up on a tree and get me these young birds and shoo away the mother. That's the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKad. So he climbed up on the tree and he fell off the tree and he died. Now Elisha ben Avliya said, there are only two commandments in the Torah, where the Torah says, if you live a long, that if you keep them, you will live a long life. One is honoring your parents, and the other is Shiluach HaKad. Here we have a boy who did both of them at the same time, and he died. He says, God is either not just or the Torah is not true, chas v'shalom. So he became a non-believer, but he was a very, very great Talmud Chacham. And Rav Meir, one of the great Tanaim of the Mishnah, used to continue to learn with Acher. He used to continue. He's called Acher. Acher means the other one. He's not even referred to by his name. He's called Acher. We don't want to even say his name. And Rav Meir continued to learn with him. And the Chachamim said, how can you learn from him? He's a heretic. So Rav Meir says, I treat him like a pomegranate. I throw away the peel, and I eat the fruit. So the big dilemma that people always have is, are we capable of learning from heretics? Are we capable of throwing away the peel and eating the fruit? Or is the danger that we'll eat the peel and throw away the fruit? And that's why you see sometimes the idea that you can't learn from this person because, I mean, the truth is, what can I tell you? There are many apikorsim in the world who say beautiful things. In other words, people who are not believers in some respects, but they have genuine insight. The problem is, are we Rav Meir? They might be Acher, but can we say that we're Rav Meir? And that's why one, you know, needs the guidance. For example, you know, again, I can tell you, the stuff that a Gadol might read, he might never allow people in yeshiva to read. Aye, the Gadol reads it, good enough for the Gadol. The answer is the Gadol, you know, at some point makes a judgment. And it's not always clear if everybody is capable of making that judgment. So, going back to your question, so one answer might be that you have to learn from Lavan, even if it's possible, cognizant of the dangers of that. The other idea might be, remember we talked about last week the fact that Avraham Avinu specifically wanted the marriage to come out of his family. So there got to be something good in the family. And you can't just say, if they're totally Rishayim, Eliezer would have been much better. So the Torah does want to be modgish, wants to emphasize at various points the goodness within the family, within the family itself. Interesting enough, I'll give you another example of that. Remember Haran. Who is Haran? Haran is Avram's other brother, right? Avram had two brothers, Avraham, Nahor, and Haran. Now Haran is the father of Lot and Sarah, right? Lot and Sarah are brother and sister. Nahor is the father of Bethuel. See, there's a lot of intermarriage. You know, there's an effect. Avraham married his niece, and then we have Nahor had Bethuel, had Rivka, and Yitzchak married Rivka, etc. And Laban then had Yaakov, and Laban had Rachel and Leah. Now, what happened to Haran? Haran died. How did Haran die? So it's brought down that when Avraham was thrown into the fiery furnace in Ur Kasdim as a child, really, because he refused to bow down to idols. Haran didn't take a position. Haran basically said, I'm going to see what happens to Avram. If Avram gets saved, I'll be for Hashem. And if Avram doesn't get saved, then I'll go with the Avodah Zarah. So Avram gets saved miraculously, and then Haran says, I'm for Hashem. And he gets thrown into the furnace and he gets burnt. Because again, the idea was that Abraham gets saved because Abraham didn't expect that he would get saved. Abraham was saved. That's why some of these stories only work the first time. Meaning to say, Abraham gets saved because he was willing to give up his life for Hashem. And he got saved in the merit of his emunah. The guy who figures nothing's going to happen to me because I'm saved does not have that level of Mesiras Nefesh. But it is brought down, though, it is brought down that in the merit of Hara dying Al Kiddush Hashem, he merited that his daughter married Abraham. He also merited that Lot, his other son, his son, would be the ancestor of Rus, who eventually, of course, is the so even Hara's little Maisa, which we look down upon, does have a lot of repercussions. So I'm just saying that Laban and Haran are going to be connected there. Yeah.
I just want to clarify what you're saying about the fact that these mixes that we have in sacred gracious were learned from behavior and not from the imperative.
Except for three. Well, I mentioned those three are imperatives. Yeah. I meant to say the other halachas are derived from behavior, therefore do not have the status of mitzvos. What is derived from behavior and observation, well, for example, Avram's chesed, right? There, we don't say, from this pasuk at least, there's a mitzvah to be kind to guests because Avram was kind to guests. We derive behavior from that, but that does not make it one of the 613 mitzvos. Okay. All right. Let me just give you one final point about the Shidduch, then we'll go on to a new Inyan. If you look, well, you don't have Chumash right, but I'll read you the pasuk. This is the last pasuk about the Shidduch of Yitzchak and Rivka, which is Perek Chavdalit Pasuk Samach Zayin, 67. So it's a long Perek. It says, Yitzchak brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. Vayikach es Rivka, and he took Rivka, and she was to him a wife, and he loved her. And then Yitzchak was comforted. So first of all, people point out, at least from this pasuk, although with Yaakov you see the opposite, this pasuk expresses the fundamental idea that the marriage is not the outgrowth of the love, but the love is the outgrowth of the marriage. This pasuk says, only after she was a wife was there then love. The concept was, therefore, that this was not a love of physical passion. She was very young anyway, but it was a love based on seeing the goodness and the unique qualities that she resembled Sarah in some ways, and it was that perception was what caused the love. So Refersh points out that this is the opposite of the infatuation that causes a desire to be married. This is something that comes later. But Rashi says a very beautiful midrash. Rashi says, what does it mean that he brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother? So Rashi says that there were three miracles that existed in the tents, in the home of Sarah Imenu. One was that the candle that she would light on Erev Shabbos lit from the whole week. That light lasted an entire week, Ner Dolek. The second was there was a bracha mitzuya be'isa. There was a special blessing in her dough that if you ate even a little bit of bread, it satisfied you, it filled you up for a long time. And the third was there was a cloud of glory. The Shechina was over her ohel. And when Sarah died, even though Abraham was alive, when Sarah died, all of those miracles stopped. Sarah had brought them and stopped. And when Rivka came as just a 3-year-old, or Chazal say 14-year-old, there are two opinions of Chazal, how old she was, all of those things came back. And that's why Yitzchak felt a sense of comfort, because this was somebody who embodied those midas. This is what Rashi said, yeah.
I understood, perhaps the last time, perhaps I extended it more than you meant, but I understood that that Rivka was this active boss that said running around, just like Avram had done.
Right.
And that Sarah had the Mita of Guru when it came in terms of hunger. So I thought the fact that these three Timanim were reinstated was not because Rivka was like Sarah, as much as the system worked, Rivka and Yitzchak, the way it worked.
Well, I think that's correct. In other words, we're not suggesting that because the same miracles came back, Rivka was Sarah. If anything, Rivka was in the opposite direction. But it means that this completion, this wholeness, this integration now allows everything to come. Now, there's a comment that the Ramban makes in the beginning of Shmos, very interesting comments, where he connects the three miracles of Sarah's tents to the three miracles of the Mishkan itself. Right? What's the parallel? Right, the Mishkan was surrounded by a cloud of glory, the Anan HaKavos, which of course, the Ramban in Shmos. The Mishkan was surrounded by the Anan HaKavos, which is the cloud of glory. The Ner Daluk, the eternal light, of course, is the western light of the menorah, which never was extinguished. Right, to this day, to commemorate that, we have a light over the Oren, near Tomet. No? Okay. All right, should be on. But okay, that's a commemoration. But in the Mikdash there was a Ner of the menorah. Actually, just to correct people's impression, the truth is, the light was actually put out every day and relit. It really was not an eternal light in this sense, but it was a light that never went out until you extinguished it. You had to extinguish it every day because there's a mitzvah to relight the menorah every day. Even with Hanukkah, people make this mistake. With the Hanukkah miracle, it was not that they put in enough oil for one day and then it continuously burned for 8 days. Oh. Halakhically, you can't do that. Halakhically, you have to extinguish it and relight it every day. But it means that they extinguished it every day, and there was enough oil where they could always relight it. You understand? Because you're not Yotze. You're not Yotze with lighting once a week and then having it go. Just like Sarah.
So Sarah did, she had to extinguish it.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. So the thing is this. So even the Ner Tamid did not mean it was never extinguished. What it meant is the following. We put in oil. The menorah was lit actually towards the evening. Every night oil was put in. In the evening, and the candles would burn all night. In the morning, we would go, and all of the candles already have been burnt down, except for this eternal light that never extinguished until we would then extinguish it, put in new oil for the other candles, and then relight them. So, even the eternal light is people don't have the proper picture of it. But that's what you did. So that corresponds with Sarah Imenu's candle.
Why did Sarah extinguish it except for a weekly basis?
Oh no, Sarah didn't have to do it daily. In the Mikdash, she had to do it daily because there's a daily mitzvah of lighting. Yes, Sarah would do it to Erev Shabbos. And the third is Bracha Be'isa, the blessing in her dough, of course, corresponds to the Lechem HaPanim, the showbread, right? There was 12 chalos in the Mishkan, in the Beis HaMikdash as well. They were put on a table, a gold table, in the Mishkan, right? The menorah is on the southern wall, and the shulchan is on the northern wall. And every Friday, the bread would be baked and put on the table, and it would not be eaten until next Shabbos, meaning the old bread would be taken away. In other words, the bread that was eaten on Shabbos was a week old, and that bread was still warm and fresh. It was a nes, the miracle of the lechem hapanim. Now, there's something very important here, the Ramban tells us. The three miracles of Sarah Imena correspond to three miracles in the Beis HaMikdash to teach us that the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan, is nothing more than a copy, a replication of the holiness that can exist in a Jewish home. The Mishkan was designed for us to see and remember what Kedusha we can create in our homes. And the Ramban's Lashon is that the Mishkan is Shavu L'Mala Sabosim. It's a reminder that we can try to return to the level of our Avos. And that's, of course, the idea. It is often said as a cliche almost that the Iker Makam Kadosh that Hashem has in the world is the Kedusha that we create in our homes and in our families. And the Ramban says this is directly connected to the three miracles of Sarei Imenu, corresponding to the three miracles of the Mishkan. By the way, the Gemara says an interesting point, just to digress, why the Shulchan with the bread is on the north side of the Mishkan, and the menorah is on the south side of the Mishkan. Which is why, by the way, in Shul, when you light a Hanukkah menorah, the menorah should be positioned in the south. The Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, therefore, the Shulchan is the vehicle through which God brings the blessings of Parnassa into the world, making a living. The menorah, which is the light of Hashem, represents the vehicle of wisdom and insight. So it says, if you want to pray for wealth, so you should daven towards the north. Meaning you're facing Yerushalayim, but you should daven northeast, let's say. And if you want to pray for Torah, you should daven southeast. You should turn towards the south. The south is the sign of wisdom, and the north is the direction of wealth. Why that is so, I don't know, but that is the identity that we're given. I always tell my show, you know, my show, which was built before I got there, sometimes many shows the Aron is not east, because whatever it is. So in my show, everybody's davening north. So I said, we have Silver Spring is overly materialistic. That's it. But, yeah.
Maybe it's a reflection of Eretz Yisrael. In the north is the area of Asher, which was all, you know, wealth and crops and everything, and in the south is Yerushalayim.
Okay, that could be. That could very well be. Also, yeah, that makes sense. Also, in terms of sun exposure, which was something, you know, we urbanites may ignore it, but it was very, very big. As you know, there is never exposure to the sun on the north. Right? In fact, the very words for directions, by the way, are correlated to the sun. Mizrach means from the shining of the sun, the rising of the sun. Marav is the setting of the sun, which is west. Darom is Dor Rum. The sun is at its highest point in the south. And Safon is hidden because there's no northern exposure for the sun. So it could very well be that if light is symbolic of wisdom, so the north is the most materialistic direction because it is obscured from the rays of the sun. Right? The sun is not visible. The sun goes east, south, and then west. You never see the sun in the north of the sky. Levin, after his wife died, once went into a camp, and the cab driver said, "You know, where do you live? Where's your house? Where's your home?" And he didn't give him an answer. He couldn't get an answer. He said, "Why don't you tell me? Where do you want to go?" He said, "Oh, then I'll tell you." He said, "Why didn't you answer the first time?" He says, "I don't have a home anymore. I don't have a home. I mean, you can't ask me where my home is." That was the bite. So this is the important lesson that the Ramban teaches us. Let me go back a little bit, though, to the beginning of this parsha. Right before the marriage, in fact, Chazal very much identified Abraham's desire to find a wife for Yitzchak with the death of Sarah. Right, we see it's connected because after Sarah dies, all of a sudden Abraham says, "I got to find a wife for Yitzchak." Now, Yitzchak is 40 years old; he's not a young man at the time. Why does Sarah's death all of a sudden make it click? I got to find a wife for Yitzchak. So there are a lot of different things you could say. One is, simple meaning might be, that when Avram sees Sarah dies, Avram obviously begins thinking about his own vulnerability, although he lived for quite a few years longer, but Avram didn't know how long he was going to live. So the concept is, I better take care of the situation. Particularly since we see in this context a very strange passivity of the part of Yitzchak. That apparently Yitzchak is not going to do it on his own unless we do it for him. And if Sarah is dead, Avram feels, I have to step in. That's one explanation. That's a simple explanation. The other explanation Rashi connects it to is, it wasn't so much Sarah's death that was the impetus, but it was the Akedas Yitzchak that was the impetus. Meaning, Avram realized, I almost lost Yitzchak. Again, I know we haven't discussed the Akedah at great length. We will come back to it. I just want to finish up the loose ends of what we talked about last week. So we'll go backwards and look at the Akedah. But certainly, the Akedah made Abraham realize that if I would lose Yitzchak, all of the divine promises about having children and a nation would be totally lost. And this made him realize that Yitzchak was vulnerable
and precarious, and we don't know how long Yitzchak is going to live. Therefore, I better do it. The third explanation actually fits with the Ramban and Rashi very beautifully. That is, Avraham sees the void now that Sarah is gone. And therefore he realizes that that void of holiness and spirituality needs to be filled. So it's either connected to Avram's sense of vulnerability and need to take charge of the situation, it's connected to the Akedas Yitzchak, or it's connected to the histalsis, the removal of those three miracles that symbolize the holiness that Sarah brought in. But it is connected to the death of Sarah. And the Parsha begins, Chayei Sarah begins, with the death of Sarah at the age of 127. So Avraham is 137. Avraham is 10 years older than Sarah. And one question that many Mephoshim have is, it says Sarah died in the city of Kiryas Arba, which is Hebron. You know where Hebron is? Kiryas Arba. Why is it called Kiryas Arba? So there are two interpretations, Rashi says. Either Arba is the name of a giant, a Canaanite giant, the city of Arba, or it refers to the city in which four pairs are buried. But of course, that would be an anachronism, would it not? Because the four pairs are Adam, Chava, Avraham, Sarah, Yitzchak, Rivka, and Yaakov, Leah. But of course, it couldn't have been called Kiryas Arba when Sarah died, because when Sarah died, there are only two pairs. One pair is buried there, Adam and Chava. That's not so difficult, though, by the way, but very often the Torah refers to place names not by what they were called at the time of the events, by what they were called at the time the Torah was given. For example, we might say in our own way, we might say, the Indians had a reservation in Annapolis. I don't know if that's true or not. Now, it doesn't mean it was Annapolis, right? But it means the place which we now call Annapolis is where the Indians had a reservation. The Susquehannock. My son's learning about Indians. I didn't know that Grandma Maryland had the Susquehannock Indians. So, in that sense, we would have to say Kiryas Arba is that same thing. It is a name, Al Shem HaAsid, that was not given yet, but we refer to. But the question I want to raise is this. Sarah died in the city of Hebron. That's not where Avraham was living at the time of the Akedah. It's true that when Avraham came to Eretz Yisrael at the age of 75, and Avraham did spend his first years in Hebron, 25 years. But then, it says he moved to the land of the Plishtim, of the Philistines. And remember, that was the second encounter with Abimelech taking Sarah, and, you know, one happened in Egypt, and once happened in Plishtim. And they lived in Beersheba. Right? So, and in fact, the Akedah itself says Avraham left from the city of Beersheba. Now, Beersheba was a Philistine city then. And you know where Beersheba is. Where it is now is where it was then, basically, in the Negev. So if Avraham and Sarah are living in Beersheba, why did Sarah die in Hebron? Hebron is not the same place as Beersheba. So what some people say, not in Forsham, what is in vogue, there is a theory in vogue, which some might regard as an apikorsis, although the Orthodox people have said it, is they interpret a whole sequence of events here that from the time of the Akedah, they don't accept. Chazal say Sarah died immediately upon hearing of the Akedah. They posit that Sarah separated from Avraham after the Akedah because she could not forgive him for being on the verge of killing their son. And this is intimated by the fact that Avraham and Sarah appear to be separate, that she's living in Hebron and he's living in Beersheba. But again, it's more or less fairly unthinkable in our traditional understanding that Sarah would regard that as an Avera. Moreover, according to Chazal, Sarah died immediately upon after the Akedah, so there wouldn't have been that time to move. So other people say this, Lefi Pshuto, Rashi assumes that what happened was Sarah was going to look for Avraham and Yitzchak. She didn't know where they went, frankly. They left. Avraham did not tell his wife where he was going. And there's reason for that. He did not tell her where he was going. They'd been gone for 3 or 4 days. Right? It was a 3-day trip. And you know, now it's on the return. It may be 6 days already. Sarah is going to look for them, as a concerned mother would do. And where would a concerned mother, if you had to find somebody who was lost, one of the places you would check are the old haunts. Where did we used to live? And they used to live in Hebron. They lived in Hebron for 25 years, and they lived in Beersheba for 26 years. That's the breakdown. And therefore she went to Hebron, both because that's where they used to live, and because it's on the way to Yerushalayim, and it's also a place of tefillah. The Marzah Machpelah was a place of prayer. And she died, and according to the Medrash, she died because in Hebron she encountered a malach, a shaliach, who said, Yitzchak got killed, and she died because of the shock. Even then, you know, there are different interpretations of that Medrash that say she died because of the shock of hearing about the Akedah. According to one explanation, the shock killed her, but according to another explanation, she was shocked because the Satan told her that Abraham and Yitzchak are coming back. And she was shocked because she couldn't believe they failed such an Nisayon. It was the opposite. In fact, the Kesav Sofer says, the reason Abraham did not tell Sarah about the Akedah, and the reason he did not take her along at the Akedah, was because that would have made it easier for him. Her inner strength would have convinced him that he had to do it, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Abraham to struggle with this Nisayon and not have Sarah make it easier. So it's diametrically opposed, the idea that Sarah would have been against this.
Well, we want to say that, by the way, the best grandson is in conversations with other people, and I've never heard that interpretation before.
Who says what I just said?
Yeah.
The Ksav Sofer says that. Ksav Sofer. Yeah, Ksav Sofer in the beginning of the Akedah says Sarah did not come along because she would have made it easier for Abraham.
Oh, I mean, I'm sorry, or that she had died because she had
I don't even remember. A lot of people say it. I don't know if I could find what Sefer says it, but this is it's said by the Velt, as we say, the Olam says. It's one of those things that a lot of people say. But it may be the Ksav Sofer says that also. I don't remember. The Ksav Sofer does say why Sarah didn't come along, and certainly the Ksav Sofer's pshat is consistent with the idea that she died and she thought they failed. So that's what
Rashi says the opposite. He says that she died because she thought that they had succeeded.
Let me see if Rashi's language is very clear. Let me just find this.
In this book, it says, it's not in English. I don't know.
I'm just trying to find the Rashi here. Which book are you looking at? Yes. I have the Rashi. Rashi says, I'll read you the whole Rashi. Nitzmecha Misa Sarah L'Akedas Yitzchak. The death of Sarah is adjacent to the sacrifice of Yitzchak. L'fish Alidei B'Sarah Sar Akeda, through hearing about the Akedas in his Damein B'Nol L'Shchida, that her son was about to be slaughtered. V'chima'at Shalom Nishchat. It was almost, well, the translation is a little ambiguous here. It says, Kemat Shalom Nishchat. In other words, at the last minute he was not slaughtered. Porcha Nishmas. No, the Rashi is ambiguous. The Rashi is susceptible to both interpretations. In fact, if anything, Rashi is very susceptible to her hearing that he wasn't slaughtered and then she died. And that's what it says.
I gotta say, as I said, my husband always gets really mad at me about it. That just doesn't make any sense. Right. Because she might have been a sedate, but she was a mother, and I can't imagine that she would be so removed from that state that, you know, she would be so in her head that she would actually. It's one thing that.
Well, the other interpretation
is. It would be another thing that she would actually feel disappointed. I just can't.
Well, the other interpretation is that she died out of an overabundance of joy and shock. In other words, you could accept that she heard that he wasn't killed, and as a result, she literally died out of the excitement of the moment. I mean, you can learn it that way too. You don't have to say she died out of the disappointments, but she died out of the sudden shock. And I know of people that have died. In other words, they thought that a child was dead, and when they got the news that a child was miraculously alive, they died. They had a heart attack. So the sudden change can do that also. So you can learn that way as well. But even the other explanation, which is said, I mean, I understand that from our vantage point, we don't think we would ever react that way. We can't imagine.
It showed the level of its tzaddik. This is a different level. This is a level of feeling that somebody didn't live al kiddush Hashem is an enormous shame for people. So I understand humanistically it's not something that we would hear. But the one thing I want to say about this is that it does say Avraham came to eulogize Sarah. I think Rabbi Weinerby has spoken about some of this. It was asked to lipchosa and to cry for her. And there's a small chaf here. I'm not sure. Did I tell you this last week? I'm trying to remember. I don't remember where I said where. Okay. So I think Rabbi Weinerby mentioned this one idea here, and that is the difference between eulogy and crying. Now, normally, in the sequence of mourning, first we cry. We cry when we first hear something, and then we eulogize. But in this case, it says there is eulogy and then crying. And again, I'm not sure exactly what point he made, and maybe this will repeat it, but one of the differences that is given is, why does a person cry when there's a death? Why do we cry when we lose somebody? So very often, the crying is because of a sense of guilt or unfulfilled opportunities. We torture ourselves and we say, if only I did this, if only I made up, if only I spoke, right? If only I had 5 more minutes. And that creates a tremendous, tremendous grief within a person. But with Avraham, apparently it wasn't that way. Avraham did not have the bechi that comes from the guilt and the incomplete and the lack of closure. There's a second type of crying, which comes after eulogy, that is, when you recognize, what is the eulogy? When you recognize the person's greatness and their holiness and their goodness, and now you recognize the gap in the world and in your life, that's a second level of crying. So the bechi before the hesped is the crying of guilt, incompleteness, lack of closure. The bechi after the hesped is the recognition of the worth and the void. And Abraham's bechi was only of the latter kind. I think it reminds me of very much of Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Thinking about the at his wife's levaya, was around 12 years ago, said a statement which is just, frankly, one of the most unbelievable statements I've ever heard. But he said that it's customary to ask forgiveness from your spouse. He says, in our 50 years, neither of us ever did anything for which we have to ask bechila. And you know, you can say many, many things about the Gadol like Rav Shlomo Zalman, but this is actually the most amazing statement. And therefore, any bechi that a person like that has is the bechi that comes from the eulogy, from the understanding of the greatness of the nifter or the nifteris, but it doesn't come from the unfinished business or the lack of closure, because there was no unfinished business on there.
Rabbi Weinreb actually quoted, so I forget who Darshan does, but it's a bechi is bingol ben asmo. Bachar kach lahas bivaradim.
Yes.
You know that sound.
Yes. So why by Abraham? Okay.
And that there was the hamon am. And that's why there was a proper eulogy. But he didn't associate Bechi with guilt. He associated Bechi with crying for yourself.
Right.
And that's why Yitzchak wouldn't have been the one to do the hesed. And he actually went to the Novi who does the hesed for his wife, Leva, in Prague. And that's what he based. He always did the Chayes Sarah on this every year.
But what he also brought down, which sort of does fit in with this, is that whenever, and I guess you really have to check with the math to see this, but wherever there's hesed first and then bechi, it has to do with our bechi first and then hesed.
Right.
The bechi comes first when it has to do with your halichos yom. If something is interrupting your way of life completely, like with the Beit HaMikdash, the bechi came first.
Right.
Because our life was turned upside down.
Right. And with Abraham?
And so he said with Abraham, his life was not turned upside down by Sarah's being next there. So,
in other words, he had the inner presence of mind where his life went up.
Well, they had
again, if you learn they were separated like that, then that actually works. But
having had Yitzchak, that was their purpose.
Right. Okay. Very good. But let me just say this though. Look at the small. There's a small chaf in the chosa, a tiny chaf.
a little hut.
And also some of the fit,
Abraham's life. That's why the Bechi comes afterwards.
Right.
Now the small chaf, the Baal HaTorim says the following. The reason it was a small chaf is because Abraham did not want to cry excessively. Small. Abraham diminished some of his grief. The Bechi was not complete. It was diminished. Diminished Bechi. So the question becomes, it's almost as if there was some restraint or some containment of the grief. And why was that so? So here, the Bali Musar say in thoughts, and they say the following. We all have the Yetzer Hara in the world, right, that tries to discourage us from doing mitzvahs. And the first thing the Yetzer Hara tries to do is discourage us from doing good things. But what if the Yetzer Hara does not succeed and we do the mitzvahs anyway? So one of the things the Yetzer Hara does, the Yetzer Hara has a ex post facto strategy, that is to make you regret, second guess, and feel bad about the good things that you've done. If it can't stop you from doing them, it can at least make you feel rotten and wish you didn't do them. And of course, in truth, there is a principle that you might call negative tshuva in the world. The same way, repenting over an aveira kind of erases the aveira. If one repents over the mitzvahs, you lose those mitzvahs as well. That could be the explanation of the famous verse, V'haser Satan, remove the Satan milfaneinu in front of me, and remove the Satan that's in back of me. The Satan that's in front of me is I want to go out of the door to do a mitzvah, and this Yetzer Hara, which is within me of course, blocks me and says, you're not going out. The Satan in back of me is after I've done the mitzvah, and I'm out of the door, there's this Satan that's whispering in the ear and saying, you're a real jerk for doing that. Actually, the Chavetz Chaim used to say another pshat. He used to say, sometimes the Satan in the back of you is pushing you to do mitzvahs, because sometimes you have to know when to hold back. Okay, so he says, look at this Akeda. Abraham just went through this experience of an Akeda. He was willing to give up the most precious thing that existed in his universe for a Kodesh Baruch. And the Satan tried to discourage him. When I say Satan, I don't mean like a little, you know, man in red outside of him, but you know, within himself, there's the thoughts and the Yetzer Hara and all sorts of arguments against it. And God promised you a child. And Abraham goes ahead and perseveres. And what is his great reward for the supreme sacrifice that he undergoes? He loses his life's companion. Sarah dies because of the Akedah. You see what the Yetzer Hara is doing. The Yetzer Hara, in effect, is telling Abraham, okay, you passed the Akedah, and now look what God gives you as your great reward. And therefore, Abraham could not allow himself to totally open up. Because if he would totally open up, it might lead to places where he doesn't want to go. It might lead to places of, why did I do this Akedah? Why did I do it? Why did I do it? And therefore, Abraham knows that certain things you can't always open up, because chas v'shalom could lead to kefira. Again, it's a difficult situation, but I mentioned this last week. I was talking about the Holocaust, and there is the idea that in one's grief and in one's mourning, and one should of course mourn and express, etc., but one has to be careful that through the grief and in the mourning, one does not turn against HaKadosh Baruch Hu and rebel and curse. This was always, in fact, Chazal actually say, Eev himself says certain things in the book of Eev that are blasphemous, according to some interpretations. And Chazal say, Ein Adam Nitvas Al Tsaro. You cannot hold a person that accountable for what they say in times of grief. Again, I remember now another story from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, again, it's a story. When his wife died, his mother-in-law was still living with him. She was very old. In fact, they lived in her house all of their married life. And they didn't know what to do, how to tell the mother-in-law and everything about the wife dying. And he said he'll do it himself. He didn't want anyone else to tell her. And I don't know exactly how we have such a detailed account. I read it in Chanuch Teller's book. And he went in. It was on Shabbos, apparently. But right after Shabbos. And he told her. And he said, I don't want
you to cry because we have to accept Hashem's decree with love. And she said, can I cry a little bit? And he said, not right now. She says, no. And he said that we'll get up and we'll say Dayana Emes together and we'll rip our garments together. And the notion is because he says, and she says, how can I, she was like 95, very weak, a very frail woman. She said, how can I do this? He said, you've been at Tzedekes all your life. And you can be at Tzedekes now also. Yeah. So, again, this notion of containment to be makabel the Gezeira of Hashem is why the Bali Musar say Abraham's Bechi was with a small chah. So it's connected to the Akedah very much. But perhaps a lighter vein. There is a halachic, a very technical halachic reason. It's homiletical, undoubtedly, but it actually brings forth a lot of halachas of why there's a small cup. And here you have to follow a little bit. The thing is this. When did the Akedah take place? According to most Midrashim, the Akedah Yitzchak was on Rosh Hashanah. But there is a minority view in the Midrashim that the Akedah Yitzchak was on Yom Kippur. Now let's figure this out. The Akedah is a three-day trip, right? They're 3 days from where they were. So if the Akedah was on Yom Kippur, so that's the 10th of Tishrei, they started back the next morning, so they traveled the 11th, the 12th, and the 13th, 3 days. So they got into Chevron the 14th of Tishrei, which is Erev Sukkot. So in effect, based on this Cheshbon, Sarah was buried Erev Sukkot. Now what is the halacha this very day, if, God forbid, somebody gets buried Erev Yom Tov? So the halacha is the Yom Tov, the onset of the Yom Tov cancels Shiva. The Shiva is only the part that you were. Now, how do you count the Shloshim, the 30 days of mourning? So the way it works is the following. The little portion of Erev Sukkot, which was your Shiva, actually counts as 7 days towards Shiva. The 7 days of Sukkot count as another 7 days towards Shloshim. And Shmini Atzeres, because it's a separate autonomous holiday, equals 7 days. So in effect, if one has a mace Erev Sukkot, then one only has to keep 9 days after Sukkot for the 30-day mourning period.
I thought
Sukkot canceled out the Shloshim. No, Sukkot does not. Sukkot would only cancel out Shloshim if you buried somebody before Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur cancels out Shiva, and then Sukkot will cancel out the Shloshim. But if you bury Erev Sukkot, it cancels out the Shiva and not the Shloshim. Okay? In other words, a Yom Tov only cancels out a portion of the mourning that began before the Yom Tov. Now, if you add this up, therefore, the following. If Sarah was buried Erev Sukkot, so in terms of the Shloshim, you only have to keep 9 days after Sukkot. So if you add together the real mourning days, because Yom Tov are not really days of mourning, all you have is Erev Sukkot and 9 days after Sukkot. That equals 10 days. So of the Shloshim, 20 days were deducted. Therefore, there's a small chaf, because the period of the 30 days of mourning was diminished by 20 days. Okay, then that's the cheshbon. And in fact, it's very good, because it describes 30 days as bechi, days of crying. So the yemei bechi were diminished by 20 days. Right, that's a pet of the drush. Yeah.
It's been from high
Arab
people died, though.
We do not. Well, that's normally true. That's a good point. A very good point. Of course, it happened on Rosh Hashanah. You wouldn't eulogize either. Either way, that's going to be a difficulty. To that question. Well, I mean, the answer is ultimately. I mean, that's why the whole thing is difficult. Ultimately, were the Yom Tovim observed then? This is before Matan Torah. Were the prohibitions against eulogy in effect then? They were not, because they're only rabbinic. It all goes back to the issue of, which is a more general issue, how far are we obligated to assume in our understandings that the Avos kept all of the commandments that are not given until later? Right? That's really the fundamental issue. Do we assume that Abraham kept Sukkot? Right? Are we making that assumption at all? Do we assume that Abraham kept Shloshim? Do we assume that Sukkot cancels Shiva? Right? Do you make all of these assumptions? That's really the central problem. Now, Abraham served the angels, right? Meat and milk. So people say, well, that's why he first gave them the milk and then the meat. They get around it. But another approach would be that we're not mechuyev to assume that before Matan Torah, every single commandment was kept in the same way. They weren't obligated yet. Okay, so that would be part of that.
Also, it is true that the thing is that for a great Talmud Chacham or a great Tzaddikus, you're allowed to say some words of eulogy, even on Erev Yom Tov. Okay, well, maybe we'll stop.